Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, the call will be starting in just a moment. If you'd be so kind, please. I have two first-time callers tonight, one from Washington, Virginia. Would you be so kind as to let me know your first name, please?
Okay.
Washington, Virginia. Yeah.
Charles.
Charles. Thank you, Charles. Welcome to the call.
Thank you.
And next is Ava, Missouri, ending in 4144. May I know your first name, please?
Sally.
Thank you, Miss Sally. How'd you hear about our call?
Tommy Trucker.
Okay. Thank you. Excellent. Welcome, Tommy. Welcome, Tom. Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We'll spend about 12 minutes on a disclaimer, and then I'll pick up the history lesson where we left off, and then we'll turn the call over to PJ. Tonight's call is about what the problems are and identifying them, and you're going to be shocked with some of the court cases that you'll hear. Then PJ will show you the solutions. People that are on this call is tied with a Monday night call. Monday and Tuesday is about solutions. And I hope that's why you're here tonight, for the solutions.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law, or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. the reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can.
Yes.
Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you'll get them one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider. And even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at your remedies in the law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very much. That was a great disclaimer. We appreciate that. I want to welcome the first-time callers, Charles and Sally. Welcome. We have, four more that I'd like to get your first name, please, just for my records here, if you don't mind. This is Springfield, Missouri, ending in 8000. Phone number ending in 8000. May I have your first name only, please? Springfield, Missouri, phone number ending in 8000. May I have your first name only, please?
Rejoice.
Rejoice. Great. Beautiful name. Thank you for coming on the call.
Thank you.
Give me one moment, please. Excellent. Let me fix this. Next is, near my hometown here, Jacksonville, Florida. If I may have your first name only, please. Jacksonville, Florida. First name only, please.
Sally, good evening, Michael.
This is Sally?
Allie.
S-A-L-L-Y.
No, E-L-L-Y.
E-L-L-Y. Oh, okay. Thank you, Miss Allie. Yep. Yep. Got you now. Got you now. All right. Thank you so very much. We have a first-time caller in, it looks like, Ellie, Nevada. May I have your first name only, please?
Carrie.
Carrie.
Correct.
K-A-R-Y?
K-E-R-R-Y.
Oh, great. How'd you hear about us, Carrie?
A friend of mine recommended that I get on the phone and listen to you.
Okay, I think that friend of yours works for sheep.
No, actually, no? He works in Elmer Bloom. He works.
Valley. That's the other friend. That was my second choice. Okay, very good. Thank you so much, Carrie. I appreciate you. You're going to enjoy tonight. And then lastly is, looks like Plano, Texas, if I may, ending in 5138. Just your first name only, please. Plano, Texas, 5138. First name only, please. All right. We'll come back to you later, possibly. Thank you so much. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I have coalesced what's going on, if you would, with our new information provider, GW, and how it directly relates to what PJ has been sharing with us for a number of years now on the Tuesday night call. And point in fact, I will somehow be tying them together in a unison. What PJ talks about is solutions and the problems. Now, PJ's solutions at this time has been strictly dealing with the problems and arguing and trying to force the courts and bring the courts into a position where they recognize the fact that there's two land jurisdictions in our nation and there are two jurisdictions as it pertains to people or persons, depending. And then how that co-joins with GW on the Monday night call is that GW offers a service wherein you can get the State Department of the United States to recognize you as not being a federal citizen, but rather being a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states. This is critical. In fact, we will not be taking on any new students for PJ and his team unless they first get the status corrected. And the simple reason for that is you can make a long – you're giving them the nuclear option, if you would. You're giving PJ and the team the nuclear option to deal with your issues, whatever they may be, with regards to government. So that's what we're doing there. Just wanted to make sure that we were going to be understanding that and coming on the same page. Now, let me see. Where is this? Okay, we've been doing class, haven't we? So we're going to continue class now. When we started with this 7 weeks ago, it was first how you were born as a first-class citizen. Then we followed up with the big picture. In other words, the 30,000-foot view. Then we talked about how Congress converts state citizens into federal citizens. Then we talked about the origin, how the federal citizen came about. It wasn't there to begin with. Then we talked about how state citizens are converted into federal citizens. Then we talked about the common law versus commercial law. And then we talked about some more glue that kind of held it all together and put it all in perspective. Tonight, we're going to talk about lost rights. And then we'll turn the call over to PJ, and hopefully what we're talking about here with lost rights, PJ will springboard off of that and bring you home and show you how his efforts and the team efforts can correct and assist you in your issues. A state citizen has the right to have any gun he or she wishes without it being registered. No background checks, nada. On the other hand, a federal citizen does not. Federal citizen is strictly controlled whether they may or may not even have a firearm. And then once it is given to them that they may have a firearm by permission, by license, then they're told and highly regulated on how they may use it, where they may use it, how many rounds of ammunition they may have in a magazine, and so forth and so on. In the District of Columbia, that's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of our federal constitution, i.e. 10 miles within the seat of power, it is a felony to own a handgun unless you are a police officer or a security guard or if the handgun was registered before 1978. The District of Columbia has not been admitted into the Union. Therefore, the people of the District of Columbia are not protected by the Second Amendment or any other part of the Bill of Rights. Despite the lack of legal guns in the District of Columbia, crime is rampant. It is called the murder capital of the world. And this should prove that gun control and victim disarmament laws do not work in America, nor anywhere else, frankly. Across the country, there's an assault on our guns. If you're a federal citizen and you're using your Second Amendment arguments to protect your rights to keep your guns, I believe you are in for a surprise. First, by registering gun owners and then renaming guns assault weapons and handguns, those in power will take away your civil rights to bear arms. Of course, we have learned on these calls here now is that we're not talking about civil rights, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about our natural rights. Civil rights are only, actually, for former slaves. And I don't know of any of them that are still alive today. So there's no need for any of us to have civil rights or to talk about civil rights. We only should be interested in natural rights. The Supreme Court has ruled that you as an individual, which, by the way, is a legal word of art, meaning you're a federal citizen, you have no right to protection by the police. Their only obligation is to protect society. I don't know how they can word that around to make sense, but that's what they're saying. The real protection for state citizens to keep their guns is not the Second Amendment, but the Ninth Amendment. We should note that in Switzerland, every household must have, by law, a fully automatic machine gun and ammunition. You know, I don't think this will come as a surprise to anybody, but the crime in Switzerland is very, very low. I wonder why. A state citizen has the right to travel on the public easements. That's another word for public roads, without being registered. A federal citizen does not. It is a privilege for a foreigner to travel in any of the several states. If you are a United States citizen, you are a foreigner in that state. The state legislatures can require foreigners and people involved in commerce, people like chauffeurs, freight haulers, Uber drivers, it can be required to be licensed, insured, and to have their vehicles registered. When you register your car, you turn over power of attorney to the state. At that point, it becomes a motor vehicle. If it is not registered, then it is not a motor vehicle, and there is no motor vehicle statutes for you to break. There are common law rules of the road. If you don't cause an injury to anybody, then you can't be tried for anything. Simple as that. If your car is registered, the state effectively owns your car. The state supplies a sticker to put on your license plate every time you re-register that motor vehicle. Look closely at the sticker on your plate, and you may be surprised to see that it says, quote, official use only, end quote. We should note in some states that they don't use stickers on the plates. And you may have seen municipal vehicles that have signs on them that say official use only on them. But why does yours? You do not own your car. You may have a certificate of title, but you probably do not have the certificate of origin. And you're leasing the state's vehicle by paying the yearly registration fee. Because you're using their equipment, they can make rules up on how it can be used. If you break a rule, such as driving without a seat belt, you've broken the contract, and an administrative procedure will make you pay the penalty. A state citizen, on the other hand, must be able to explain to the police officers why they are not required to have the usual paperwork that most people do. They should carry copies of affidavits, which you learn about on the Monday call that is part of your solution here. and you have other paperwork in your car. The state citizen should also be prepared to go to traffic court and share that information with the judge. A state citizen has the right to have any gun he wishes. A state citizen has the right to travel anywhere they wish to. So, ladies and gentlemen, with that having been said, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to PJ, and we're going to be illuminated as to how to fix the problem, one way or the other. Go ahead, PJ.
Yeah, it's interesting. We use the word citizen quite a bit. If you go into the United States Constitution, I believe that's where it's at. I think it's listed like 14 times citizen. And in every case, it has a capital letter until it gets down to the 14th Amendment, I believe, or at least to the amendments, which is 1791. And then that is the first time it's handwritten with a small c. So it appears to us that, and Michael and I, we've talked about this, that small c is indicative of a legal person that is not afforded the Bill of Rights. So, and it makes perfect sense. But anyway, anytime you use the word citizen, make sure you define it at the base of your document. Otherwise, if you don't define it, they'll go to the state statutes and define it for you, and you don't want that. So basically, activity that you're doing in America, they always want to drag it into a United States court. Nobody even thinks there's an option. But the Seventh Amendment's there, and it's not going away, and that court operates for the free and independent man. When I say man, I'm talking about male and female. God created man in the male and female. So that generally, the Seventh Amendment court is generally the court that is there for your needs as a man. The United States courts are there for United States purposes. There is times when you might have a contractual relationship by location or activity with the United States, and that is the proper court to go to. But most often, the Seventh Amendment court is the proper court. The problem we have today is the United States does everything they can from grade school up. You start saying the Pledge of Allegiance and you start getting the mindset that there's nothing else except this, the United States to pledge allegiance to. And that continues through high school, grade school, high school, college, graduate. And especially so in employment, if you're working for the government, they have really no concept of another jurisdiction because they're essentially brainwashed into thinking that the United States jurisdiction is the only one, which is horrible. Every church in America should be learning the principles of the different jurisdictions and educating their people on that. But guess what? The churches got deceived into accepting benefits and privileges from the United States, which they would have had anyway, but they rushed to sign up because the lawyers in their congregation said, oh, this is a good deal. You got to be signed up. Your property, your land will be tax-free. Little did they know that the land was tax-free anyway. Most land is tax-free. The land that is of the government requires a payment to use that land. They call it taxes. They call it property taxes. Land that is on, or property that is on their land, like houses and buildings and tools and livestock, that's called property tax. And it's being taxed not because you own it, but because they have a presumption that you're using that material, the livestock and the equipment and the cars and so forth, on their land. So it's a land jurisdiction based. They do not have any authority to apply a property tax on land that is not of the United States. Now, in some situations, they have a thin nexus to the land and gives them right for taxation, but they have to produce that thread of jurisdiction. You do not have to. What we do is we go in and we challenge the United States, basically, which is any city, county, state, or municipality, to produce evidence of authority to have some taxing authority. This is one way to put it. This is the main way to put it. Either you have, if you buy land and they have no ownership interest in that land, you have absolute taxing authority. That means no one else has any taxing authority. Now, if it's government land, sometimes they have absolute taxing authority. Sometimes they just have limited taxing authority. And they have to produce that document because everything that's taxable is going to be proven by records, document records. They don't have any taxing authority apart by clearly conveyed ownership right. I think they can get somewhat taxing authority contractually. If you enter into a contract with them, they might be able to use that as taxing authority, but it has to be clearly defined in the contract. What we're getting to the point of nipping that in the bud, all those presumptions, with this process of presenting the proper documents to the United States officials, predominantly the Secretary of the State of a given state, and make him acknowledge that they have no governance authority over you, and you get a certificate or a statement from them that you are not a United States person or state person. I don't know how they're going to start out identifying them or what language we'll use, but you'll carry that document with you, and whenever a United States agent or officer or employer or anyone taking United States written law and trying to apply it to you, or county written law, city written law, or municipal county municipalities written laws and applying it to you, you can show them that document, and they will probably call their lawyer and leave you alone. The document indicates that you have there's no evidence that you have a governance, that you possess anything that's supposed to be governed by the United States. And that includes the cities, the counties, the states, and the municipalities. Pretty much everything. I would assume that they could try to give you a parking ticket, and you can present that document, and they can't give you a parking ticket. Now, the owner of the land can regulate the duration of you parking in front of their business, for example, but the state cannot come in and dictate it to you. Now, the owner of the land, he would have to go into common law to convince a jury potentially that you can't park in front of his house or in front of his business, which in some cases the jury is going to say, no, we don't want your semi parked in front of his house. Go buy your own land and park in front of that land. Don't park in front of somebody else's land. The jury would say that's unreasonable to think that you can just park your big truck or your car in front of somebody else's house all the time while he doesn't have a place to park, and he owns the land all the way to the center of the street, and he doesn't even get a park there. I mean, that's kind of crazy. They would mostly agree with you. And they'll probably have the wisdom to understand that some people are going to park there for short times and then move on. because you got to park somewhere to run in and say hi to somebody. So that's going to be pretty exciting, I think, because some people over the years that I've come across have received this document from, I think, the Secretary of State with the state seal on it, and they carry it with them, and they show it to the police, and the police run it on their records, and their records agree with the document. It says, do not arrest, do not detain. That doesn't mean you can go out and stand on government land and murder somebody or rob a bank. You're going to be arrested because that's a felony, but they're going to have evidence of a crime. They're going to have to personally attest. If a police officer is in a car and he sees you doing an activity and he believes that he can convince a jury that it's wrong for you to do that, he can, if it's an arrestable offense like a felony, which gets a little tricky because what in common law, you know, what's a felony? But they can arrest you and hold you just like any other man could hold you. If I see you robbing a bank, I don't have to go get a police officer to arrest you. I can arrest you right there. And I can tie you up. I can't kidnap you. I can't abuse you. I have to use some restraint, a lot of restraint, and protect you from unnecessarily harm. But I can detain you until other people show up to help with the matter at hand. And if there's a valid reason why you were coming out of the bank with a gun in your hand and a bag of cash in the other hand, and you can explain yourself, then we'll let you go. But if not, you can be prosecuted in a common law setting for theft, for a biblically supported crime against society and against individual men. So, Michael, anybody calling in yet? You said you had some new people. There are probably going to be several questions.
Well, my goodness, yes, you've doubled your audience since we've started this.
No.
Your audience has doubled, the people that are listening to you. And the key to it, and everyone needs to understand this, PJ has focused, and the team have focused all these years in identifying, teaching you how to identify the difference between the two state citizenships, the two citizenships, one being state, one being federal, and the two land jurisdictions, one being state, one being federal, and how you've all been conned and been subject to acting as though you're a federal citizen when you're not. Up until this point in time, and the future is yet to be shown to us, but up until this point in time, it has been, what is it called? Mano-a-mano battling, one-on-one fighting. Everyone that comes in as a student for PJ and the team, that is a unique individual battle, and it will continue to be that way. But we've got a tool, finally, that changes the entire paradigm, because with what the team has been doing, with PJ leading it, is getting the courts through various flurries of motions and filings, et cetera, and demands for their for them to evidence on the record, jurisdiction, so forth. We now have a tool to correct the status, and it comes from the State Department of the United States. I mean, how cool is that? I mean, there's nothing been like this before. There has been nothing like this before. And we have a tool now. You have a tool at your disposal that can change everything prayerfully very, very quickly. Now, what I say we don't know about it is what the future holds is because we do know what the past is. The focus of the past is in regards to changing your status has been on traffic. Basically, that's it. Others may have tried other things that I'm not aware of, but the focus has been traffic. And, you know, for the last 13 years, it's been traffic. Well, anyone that's been on these calls knows that there's a case that we quote that directly says from the court, 14th Amendment citizens don't have the right to travel as citizens of the several states. Says it right there in a court case. And now we have, we don't have to fight for the court to recognize, because we have something that is now, what's the word? It's a type of evidence. Authentic. It's self-authenticating evidence. It doesn't even require a witness. Self-authenticating evidence comes from the government. When the government produces something, publishes something, it's self-authenticating. You don't have to subpoena somebody in to give testimony on the record. It's self-authenticating. And now we have the ability to bring you so you can acquire self-authenticating evidence. So whether you're doing something in traffic or whether it's the IRS, whether you actually committed a crime, you know, 2 decades ago, 3 decades ago, you served your 5 years, your 12 years, whatever you served. If that crime was founded upon federal statutes, it's void. It is void. And it can't be tried twice. It can't do double jeopardy on you. So if it's voided and you spent 13 years in jail, that's wrongful imprisonment. I wonder how much money you'll get for that. Anyways, it's an incredible opportunity here. And I want to thank PJ for all the work that he does and the team. And even though there's going to have the calls on Monday that we have with GW, that's not the end-all solution. That's just the tool. What GW is bringing you is only the tool. Nice to have with you in your car when you're going down the road and some law enforcement officer decides to give you a blue light special. You can hand them the paperwork from the State Department of the United States. They go back to their office, their rolling office, and they use the magnetic strip and swipe that, and it comes back on their monitor. Do not arrest. Do not detain. Do not investigate. Release. Isn't that nice? No traffic ticket. No traffic court. Well, the big thing is that since driving is a federal thing for federal employees and federal citizens, and traveling is not, then that means that anything that's under the federal Code of Federal Regulations, the CFR, it doesn't apply to you. Nothing applies to you in the Code of Federal Regulations. Bingo. So we're just, whoa, great, excited about this. I know PJ is and everyone else is. So George is our first one to raise his hand. Press star 2 in your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. We have a lot of first-time callers tonight. And so press star 2 on your keypad. That'll raise your hand, and I'll unmute your phone, and we'll go and talk. We'll let you talk to PJ directly about it. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, you'll see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side in the middle of your monitor. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or your question. Outside the rectangle, you'll see a place where it's asking for a little contact information from you. Then hit submit. And I'll give voice to your comment and your question. So let's start with George in Santa Barbara.
Hello there, everybody. PJ, I've got a multi-pronged question here. It has to do with ownership. Let's take, for example, a vehicle. The first case would be somebody has already purchased a vehicle. They've registered with the state. They get their tags every year. And now they decide they want to unwind that and not have to continue to do that. The first question would be, I imagine that that's possible. You know, how would they do that? And I'll just roll these all out, and then you can answer them all at once. The next part is, so what if somebody just goes to purchase a new car, they go into the dealership, and they buy their car, and usually part of that is you register it, you get your tags, your license plates, and all that stuff. How do you respond when you're in there? Do you tell them to not do that and just drive off the lot with no plates, and they'll be fine with that if you show them proper documentation. And then the third part of this is, what happens if you purchase this vehicle using the charitable religious trust from Bernie? Now it's It's registered in the name of the trust. And what is the trust considered in terms of being, what type of citizen or entity are they, and are they required to have a license and tags and all that? And if they aren't, how do you go through and put that into place so that it doesn't have to register the vehicle?
Well, your first question dealt with if somebody owns an automobile and they naively went down and licensed it and registered it and paid the taxes on it and put plates on it and tagged it every year. What we're going to do is, in those situations, is were you eligible or qualified to register your vehicle? Because that you're supposed to be, if I understand it right, it's the same thing as a driver's license. You're supposed to be a United States citizen if you want to register your vehicle with the United States. Now, when you go to a county, it's a subdivision of the United States. When you go into statutes at large, the word county means a possession or territory of the United States. So these county offices are subdivisions of the United States, and the United States deals with United States persons. And if you're going to go in there and get a driver's license or a marriage license or a fishing license, guess what? They're going to give you a United States fishing license, marriage license, a driver's license. And if you're not eligible or qualified for that fishing license, marriage license, or driver's license, if there's something about you that you don't meet the standard, the requirements, then you are not eligible for those. And if you do have one, you just have a pretense of having one. You don't really have such a license because you don't qualify for it. I think what we're going to be doing is we're going to force the United States agencies to produce evidence that you were eligible or qualified to register your automobile in that jurisdiction. And I think they're going to come up flat-footed on that and not have anything to say. Now, if somebody, let's just say somebody else registers the car and you purchase it and you decide not to register it, which they make it extremely hard on you. They generally tow it and steal it from you. I did come across a case opinion of a judge years ago that said that the new buyer doesn't inherit any of the contracts of the prior owner. Zero, none of them. For the life of me, I cannot find that case, but I assume that's going to pop up someday. So that's the angle we're going to probably take on that. Now, with this document that Michael's talking about, it's going to show that you are not a United States person, United States citizen, which is synonymous, and it may even indicate some language that you never were. We might be able to work that into the document, that they have no evidence since the day of your birth that you were never a U.S. citizen or a U.S. person as a matter of law. So that would be good. Always go back and say, go ahead, Michael.
Part of the language is when you make your declarations is ab initio, from the point of the beginning. So that's covered.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be good. Now what was the – you need any more on that first question?
That one's fine. And then the next one is if today I have I've corrected my status, excuse me, and I'm going in to buy a new car and I don't want to register it, how would that look at the dealership? Because obviously the standard procedure is the car gets registered.
You know, people do this all over the country. It's usually the wealthy people because they've got the information, the access to high-level lawyers and so forth. But just as an example, an individual purchased a car that was, today's standards, $100,000 car easily. And he he paid for it with gold and silver, and he paid a little tax on it because it was just easier to pay the little bit of tax. He only paid like $130 tax on it or something. And it was just easier to pay that little bit than to just force it through with no tax at all. And he did that at the dealership. And then he received the manufacturer statement of ownership, and he kept that with him. And he took a piece of platinum metal, which is very expensive, and he had a laser place that engraves on with lasers, and he had a copy of that MSO put on his on that plate, and he put it on the back of his car. So you could go up and you could actually see the MSO, which is proof of ownership. And now he'd have certified copies of the document with him, and he had the original MSO in a safe place where it's not going to burn, be stolen or burned up or anything. So he has absolute proof of ownership of that, sole ownership of that automobile. And he, as far as we know, he's been driving that car for, I think, 15 or 20 years with no problems, all everywhere in America. And I think he gets pulled over occasionally, but it's rare. And he just has a little booklet with him. He hands them, and they go read it, and they come back, and they hand it to him. And they go, "We've never seen anything like this. Have a good day, sir." Now, if that individual does get Michael's the program here for verification of your status, he'd be one big step ahead also. So, but anyway, that's how that works. Now, if you buy a used car, you can go through a process of forcing the state to produce evidence that they, upon the sale of the automobile, they maintain ownership interest in the automobile, which would be contrary to the case opinion that I read. Now, remember, when you read a case opinion, a judge's opinion, that's not law. That's just his best guess of the law. And, you know, the United States courts, the Supreme Courts, they don't make law. They just give opinions of the application of the law, and generally they focus on, you know, the constitutionality of it. I would assume that the state would have next, and it'd be an impossibility for them to find in the Constitution that they have a right to hold and maintain another man's property that he purchased as a right. So I think we won't have any trouble with that. And then with this document that Michael's talking about, you can show that your status, as holding your status, you are owner of that automobile, which they'll probably back off because they'll look at that status document and they'll say, "Man, this guy's miles ahead of the average legal guy out there, and best we leave him alone because we don't want anybody to know about this, because the more people that know about this, the less revenue we're going to make, the less governance authority we're going to have."
So then the last part, what about then if you use the charitable religious trust and the trust actually purchases the vehicle and I myself have no ownership of the vehicle, but I'm driving it or I'm traveling in it?
The trust has no legal ties with the United States. Now Michael's going to probably come in on this with even more knowledge, probably more knowledge than me, but as far as my understanding is, the United States has no legal interest or ties, contractual activity or association with that trust. It is completely independent of the United States. Michael, am I saying this right?
Yeah, let me segue into this if I may. First off, we'll go backwards. We'll start with this, and then I want to go towards the first and second question that you had. With regards to charitable religious trusts, this is under ecclesiastical jurisdiction. Rather, what you're accustomed to is chancery jurisdiction or admiralty jurisdiction, et cetera, through the circuit courts. It's two separate places. And unless you commit a crime with this property that has four rubber tires on the ground, there is no nexus for them to come into it. So if a charitable religious trust owns it, it owns it under the ecclesiastical laws, not under civil law. So you don't have any nexus there whatsoever. And just like with any charitable religious trust, you've heard Bernie talk about it many times, saying you can't commingle taxable funds with your non-taxable money in the charitable religious trust. You can't do that, and you can't operate right. a criminal enterprise because it pierces both of them. Well, conversely, if you damage somebody else's property with your automobile, even though it's in a charitable religious trust, you have breached. That trust has now been breached into civil realms because property was damaged. So that's the answer to that. To the first question, there is a simple process wherein, and the people that use it all the time are those people that buy cars for junk. They notify the Department of Motor Vehicles that such and such vehicle has been sold for junk or for scrap, and to remove the VIN from the rolls. Another thing that you can do is call it abandoned on your property. So you buy it from John Doe, you got his bill of sale, and you have it on your property, and then you notify the Department of Motor Vehicles or whatever that you have an abandoned vehicle, here's the VIN number, and you're going to keep it or whatever. That removes it from their that roll. The other question is, what do you do with you want to buy a new car? Well, I did that here. I tried that here in the state of Florida, or Florida State, whichever you want to call it. And I said, look, I have cash. I want to buy that car cash, but I'm not buying it unless I get the manufacturer's certificate of origin. And he goes, we can't give that to you. We must, by law, send it to Tallahassee. And I called him on it. I says, can you show me the law? And he goes, no, I'm not going to get involved with this. Go somewhere else, basically. And I laughed and walked out. Point being, though, is I have a dealer in the southwest of the United States, and I won't give out any more information unless there's something that you're ready to do, and then I'll work with you on it. But he doesn't care, and he will be happy to purchase from wherever you are, dealer to dealer, and you pay him the cash, he'll purchase the car, and then he'll send you the manufacturer's certificate of origin. You'll get it, 3-6 weeks later from him. When he gets it, he'll forward it to you. I've known the guy forever, and it's the way I'll be making my purchases. So I think, does that answer all three questions?
Well, I mean, just back to the trust, that sounds a little bit onerous that you, because, I mean, Bernie has been recommending that if you're getting a house or a car or a plane or whatever, that you isolate these in these trusts for asset protection. And
correct.
Then, and the whole story of, Kennedy, when he went off the bridge and his car was
correct.
In a trust, so the people sued him and that was all they could get. So if you have it in the charitable religious trust and you do get into an accident, what happens then? You just basically...
Well, there's two things that are recognized, and I haven't, there's nothing onerous at all with what I said.
Huh?
What I've said is in complete agreement with Bernie. The thing is in a trust, so any trust, whether it's civil or charitable or ecclesiastical or whatever, any trust insulates and isolates. That's what it does. So the Kennedys didn't have a religious trust that I'm aware of. It was just a secular trust. But Teddy Kennedy didn't own anything. On paper, he's a pauper. So there was nothing that they could take from Teddy Kennedy. And the only thing that they had was because the vehicle was in the trust, and it was the trust that caused the death, they could take the vehicle. And if it's in a charitable religious trust, the same thing. They can take the vehicle.
Okay.
And
so that's mean the trust is purely, it's no longer protected, but all you lose is the vehicle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's fine. Good. That clarifies that.
Okay.
Kennedy's family could have come against him under common law and sued and relied on a common law jury to determine damage. Of course, in that status system that they pretty much nobody knows anything about common law, so they were stuck with the statutory limitations and basically didn't get anything. Now, Kennedy was making pretty good wage just from being, was he congressman or senator? Mm-hmm. I can't remember. Probably senator. So he was probably bringing in a couple hundred thousand dollars just from that job alone. And the common law jury could have awarded half of that to the family the rest of his life, possibly, or something like that. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the common law jury has a tremendous amount of authority. Everything the Bible allows the juries can do.
One of the things that I want to talk about in the future, that one of my plans for the future, and PJ just hit on it, is we will develop a common law system out of the people that have become have corrected their status. Because the people that have corrected their status are uniquely citizens of the freely associated compact states, and they are constitutionally required to organize. Create grand juries, create petit juries, create trials, indict, and do all of this, and we will be doing it. Just that on itself. If you let's just say that you had a, there was a murder that you committed 20, 30 years ago, and you know you just got out of prison. Was that by a jury? Were you convicted by a jury of your peers? Well, if you are a state citizen, how could federal citizens convict you? They can't. They're not a jury of your peers. I mean, there's just so much opportunity with this. I almost start blabbering just because of it. George, anything else?
No, that's good for now. Thanks.
Great. Great questions, George. Thank you so much. Next is Michael, followed by Ellie. So we go to Michael next with a question.
Oh, good evening. Am I on?
Good evening.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes. This is a Verizon commercial, right?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. I can hear you now.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Two short things. One, the state of Nevada, if you pay cash for a car, you can get the original manufacturer's equipment certificate, and you have to ask for it. They don't give it to you. You have to demand it. And the other thing, Charles the other night called in, and he was having some doubts, or some people he talked to were having doubts about what you're talking about. And all they have to do is open, I don't know about all the titles, but Title 26 has definitely in the first couple of pages, voluntary and mandatory. And that's as far as you got to go. If it was mandatory for everybody, they would stick with it. But if it's voluntary, why is it voluntary? So everything you're telling them is on the up and up. And yes, we have two systems of government. One of them is very corrupt. So that is just what I wanted to throw in there for you tonight.
Appreciate you,
Michael. And then one of the questions you can raise, if they ever say you volunteered, ask them to produce the evidence of what you said, did, or signed to volunteer. So they have to produce that.
Where's the full disclosure with two witnesses' signatures? I don't see them having any evidence.
Nope.
Because everything they've done has been fraudulent. Yep, thank you. Have a good evening.
All right, we're going to go now to Miss Ellie.
Yes, thank you, Michael. Getting back to question number 3 from the previous caller, when you purchase the automobile under the CRT, technically, because of the CRT and the tax, the special tax situation of the CRT, that automobile should not be taxable. Right? So that means that you would not pay the state or the tax, the registration, let's put it this way. Right?
Yeah, there's no nexus for taxation.
Automatically, regardless of any change of status from the, whoever's going to be.
They have no evidence they have no evidence of what they call taxing authority. If they claim taxing authority, they have to disclose it. And once they disclose it, you can bring it to us and we can examine it. And usually when they disclose taxing authority, we can examine it and find out that they're missing some key elements into maintaining taxing authority. For example, you don't live on their land. and the car wasn't manufactured on their land, things like that. Go ahead.
Now, what happens if... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I had, as a someone that owned a business, I was deep in the system for 25, 30 years. I had a tax-exempt card from the taxing authority of the state of Florida. And whenever I made purchases, I just gave them those numbers, and they wouldn't charge me tax. They wrote the numbers down. But this is not about being tax exempt. It's something else. It's not being tax included in the tax.
Right.
And
right.
That's something that churches normally do. So I have yet to take the time to pursue it. I got other things on the front burners to do, but I will be post event, whether it's a reevaluation of the currency or it's Mike G or whatever, as soon as I've got time and I can afford to hire people and bring workers in and stuff like that, I will be pursuing the tax collecting authority of the state of Florida with regards to the charitable religious trust and the corporation SOL. It will be investigated. Anything else, Ms. Ellen?
And also, it's possible that if your status is corrected, that the state may be required to give you a card to show that, provided you do not purchase any goods on government land, you're not tax included.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Just out of curiosity, so let's say you're in this situation with this automobile, and somebody else who is not, has not adjusted their status yet, and has a driver's license, for example, borrows the vehicle, and is stopped by a police officer. Is there a discrepancy between an automobile which has a special status because of its original owner, and the actual individual that is, or man, woman, who in this case, in person, who is driving that automobile?
No, because the,
in other words, the automobile is under one status, and but that particular person traveling driving.
It's not the automobile so much; it's the activity. If you're doing an activity that's taxable, then you're taxable. If you're doing an activity that's not taxable, you're not taxable. Now, they claim that you're taxable because of your status. Now, that's going to be evidence is not operating. Therefore, they got to find another reason to tax you,
which is
in some situations they may have that, but it's probably going to be very rare. And you, for example, if you're driving a car, and you pull onto a toll road, and there's all kinds of signs that says if you drive on that road, you're going to get taxed for using it. Yeah, you got to pay the tax. So
of course,
stay off that road.
All right.
I have an answer for you directly. In the United States Code, Section 31, 18 U.S.C. Section 31, under definitions, subsection 6 says the term motor vehicle means every description of carriage or other contrivance propelled or drawn by mechanical power. I guess they weren't thinking of Tesla then. And used for commercial purposes, on the highways, in transportation of passengers and property, or property and cargo. Passengers do what? It's commercial. They pay you to take you somewhere. Cargo is somebody pays you to take this box from here to there. It's all about commerce. So it has to do,
correct,
like PJ says, what is your activity?
Right. Okay.
Now, if you're a U.S. person, I've read case law that says if you're a U.S. person, you're perpetually in commerce. So, but anyway, this status correction is going to take that out of the way. So you'll be good.
Absolutely.
Yeah, one of the court cases that we read frequently says that if you are domiciled in Washington, D.C., having a residence in one of the several states, you are engaged in interstate commerce. Period. All right. Thank you so much, Miss Ellie. Next, last will be Dina from Menlo, Georgia. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm sorry, I'm a little hoarse. I've had a. How are you doing? I've got a
I'm
question.
A little donkey.
I'm a little hoarse, so excuse me.
I'm a little donkey.
Yeah, I know. That's what I feel like. Anyway, I was wondering about the insurance on this. Do you have a trouble with the insurance companies getting these insured?
Haven't got
no,
that
they don't
far
even.
Yet.
Most insurance companies don't even ask if it's licensed or if you're anything. They just ask for the VIN number and the owner's name, and that's it.
Okay.
And then they ask you, you know, who's going to be driving it, of course, and things like that. But most people are going to probably insure their automobile because it's too much risk not to be insured. They'll insure it with no problem.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, gentlemen.
Yeah,
good to be on the call.
Also for people that are wanting to basically self-insure, And that's okay, too. I know that here in Florida, you can deal with the Department of Motor Vehicles, in the insurance division, and you can actually post a bond, which is the equivalent of having insurance. And they give you a sticker, a card. It's like 3.5 by 5 card, something like that. And it shows that you are self-insured and you're covered under this bond in the state of Florida. There you go.
Now, they do not have
questions?
They have no ability to require insurance from you unless they can prove that you have a history of damaging people on the open roads, and that a court jury would generally say, yeah, that person is careless, and if they want to get back out on the road, they have to have insurance. But that's pretty rare that we see that.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. I don't see any more questions. Let's give another round to give an opportunity. Press *2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question. Otherwise, we're going to say good night. Press *2. Let me hit refresh just to make sure that... Let me check Freedom's Radio. Refresh. Nope, nothing there that's on a question. Well, thank you all for joining us this evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, PJ. Again, I want to remind everyone on this call that Monday is the solution to add give you the leverage that you need to deal with things to be a free man or woman. Simple as that. So until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.